I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. My guest today is the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore, Marilyn Mosby. In the 2014 primary, she defeated her former boss, Greg Bernstein, by 10 points, a decisive victory, before running unopposed in the general election. She was swept into office by tapping into widespread dissatisfaction with increasing crime. Mosby promised to reduce it. 2 years into her term, her office has a conviction rate of 79% in homicide cases. The clearance rate of cases for the Baltimore Police Department has also improved. But Baltimore struggles with an epidemic of violent crime that has reached record levels, and the police department has been rocked by internal corruption. How do we fix this? State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby joins me when Midday starts right after these headlines. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. My guest for the hour today is Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. She was elected in 2014. In 2015, the city was rocked by violence that followed the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody. And since then, our city, like many other cities, has seen violent crime rise across categories. Nationally, according to the FBI, violent crime rose 4% from 2015 to 2016. In Baltimore, our rate of violent crime is up 11% from last year to this year. The state's attorney's office wins most of the cases it prosecutes. It has a 79% conviction rate for homicides, and it's over 90% for felony cases that haven't been dropped. But statistics tell the story of public safety only up to a point. Last month, Mayor Catherine Pugh described crime in Baltimore as out of control. Mayor Pugh, along with Police Commissioner Kevin Davis and State's Attorney Mosby, are the three public officials charged with getting it under control. And we'll talk about strategies to do that today. In a press conference last week, Governor Larry Hogan seemed to suggest that the mayor and the city were moving too slowly to turn the tide of violence in our city. The mayor disputes that, and of course, the ongoing efforts to build trust between the police, prosecutors, and the community took a major hit with the stunning indictments last spring and summer of 9 officers in the police department's most elite unit. The Baltimore Sun reports that those indictments have already led prosecutors to drop charges or to release 175 suspects because the cases against them are weakened or made untenable by the corruption scandal. So a little later in the show, we will take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to find us in the Twittersphere @midday. Tom Hall. State's Attorney Mosby, it's nice to see you.
Nice to see you again, Tom.
Welcome back and happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you as well.
So the mayor's comment that crime is out of control. What do you think? Do you agree?
So I do. I agree to some extent. I have to tell you that, you know, I always say I don't have to turn on the news and open up the newspaper to see the violence plaguing our community. All I have to do is open up my door. I live in the heart of West Baltimore, raising 2 little girls. And it's something that, you know, I'm very much invested in, not just as a top prosecutor, but as a resident of Baltimore City. And it's something that, you know, when you look at what's happening in our city, and we hear these numbers constantly, and it drives me crazy, you know, 344 homicides, 314, 335. These are not just numbers, right? Like, I attend these funerals. You know, we have the Family Bereavement Center in the state's attorney's office. I see these grieving mothers. I work with mothers of murdered sons and daughters, and I understand and recognize that these are not just statistics. These are peoples. These are communities that are being impacted. And so when you look at my role, which is, you know, the top prosecutor, traditionally the role of a prosecutor is to be reactive, right? When people have already made a poor decision, that's usually when they come in contact with me. And for far too long, that has been the only sort of role for a prosecutor. And you just cited the statistics. We prosecute between 45 and 50,000 cases a year in Baltimore City. You know, my homicide prosecutors, you talked about the 79% conviction rate. They've experienced a 20% increase in the number of homicides that they deal with. And I can tell you that the national average for a homicide prosecutor should be 20 cases. That's what you should have for a homicide prosecutor. My prosecutors have on average 54. And even despite that, they get out here each and every day, work their butts off, and they produce. So that's why we have a close to 80% homicide conviction rate. When we look at those 45 to 50,000 cases that we're prosecuting, we have last year a 93% felony conviction rate. So we're going to be tough. And I just want to be clear. That's my role, that traditional reactive role. We look at every single public enemy number one that's been designated by the police department, you know, as the worst of the worst. Of those, there's 16. Of the 12 that we've convicted, every single one of them, four are still pending. The cumulative sentences were six life sentences plus 598 years. So we're going to do the tough on crime approach when it comes to violent repeat offenders, individuals with no code of ethics, targeting women, targeting children, targeting women with children in their arms. We're going to do that. But it's also extremely important for us to take a proactive role, a holistic role, especially when you consider what's happening in our city, right? Baltimore City is located in one of the richest states in the country. And what we fail to understand, what we fail to report on, is the fact that 24% of Baltimore's population still lives in poverty. 35% of children still live below poverty. The more than 18,000 vacant houses, 16,000 vacant lots that our children are accustomed, which are mostly in poverty-stricken communities. We fail to talk about, you know, the unemployment rate for young African-American men between the ages of 18 and 24, which is more than twice as high than that of whites. We fail to talk about the median household income for you know, families within this city, for Black families, which is more than twice as low than that of whites. We don't address these systemic sort of issues as to why crimes take place. We haven't made an investment in our young people. You look at the closing of the rec centers the same day that we had Baltimore City in crisis, right, on the front page of the Sun. You turn over the front page, and they're talking about cutting funding for schools and laying off teachers. The priorities have been so off for so long. It's so important, you know, even from my perspective, to not just be reactive. We've been reactive for decades. We now have to be proactive and think long term for sustainable solutions.
I should mention as well that while State's Attorney Mosby is with us for the hour, we are streaming live on Facebook, so you can come to the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Again, our phone number, 410-662-8780, and our email, midday@wipr.org. You're exactly right, and the scholarship behind this supports completely the contention about the causes, the root causes for the violence. Poverty being the number one cause. Job, lack of opportunities for jobs and unemployment, number two. When we have one in four kids living in poverty with housing insecurity, mm-hmm. food insecurity, lack of access to health care. But I wonder how you reacted to when you heard Rod Rosenstein make a speech, which I'm almost certain you heard, about a month ago, after the day after the death of Detective Souter. So this was November 16th. He gave a speech in Chicago when he talked about controlling crime, and he talked about who's responsible for it. And he said the Baltimore City mayor admits that the crime in our city is out of control. So Rod Rosenstein, who's now the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, says, if that is true, people should be held accountable. Crime is not like the weather. If crime is out of control, it's because people failed to control it. In Baltimore, local authorities lost confidence in their ability to manage public safety, the most important function of government. Is there a crisis of confidence, and have you and the others in our city in charge of this lost the ability to control this? Did you ever have the ability to control it? Do you agree with Rosenstein's statement?
So I think that when we look at what's happening and the statement that was made, I don't believe that we can go back to some form of aggressive sort of policing, right? I think that when we look at what happened 3 years ago, that sort of disconnect, that exacerbation of distrust, you know, the Department of Justice coming in, exposing the discriminatory policing practices of one of the largest police agencies in the country. That's not what we want to revert back to. I think, again, we have to look for long-term sustainable solutions. And it's about collaboration. You know, I'm more than willing to work with the mayor, the U.S. attorney, the police commissioner, to ensure that we are developing these long-term sustainable solutions.
Rosenstein went on to say that he was speaking in Chicago, and he talked about the superintendent of police there, Eddie Johnson. And he says Johnson agrees that a consent decree is not a crime strategy. Of course, Baltimore is under a consent decree as well. That Mr. Johnson, the head of the police in Chicago, measures his success by the crime rate. So when it comes to addressing this problem, when it comes to collaborating, when it comes to figuring out what to do, what are the metrics that are justified? What metrics do you think you should be using to decide whether or not what you're doing is a good thing, or you got to change course or come up with a different idea?
So, I mean, traditionally, my metrics would be, you know, the conviction rates, right? Like, are we producing? Are we doing what we should be doing? And I don't believe that we can continue to just have that form of metrics. You know, when I am charging, and according to BPD data, you know, we've charged more juveniles this year with attempted murder and murder than the past 2 years combined. You look at something like that. We've had more than 7,000. I believe it's 5,000 robberies, only 700 of which have been solved, right? And we believe that most of these are taking place by juveniles. I feel like we are missing the mark somewhere. And so you have to kind of formulate a different level of metrics and ensure that we're making that investment on the front end as opposed to the back end. And so, yeah, from a prosecutorial perspective, we can traditionally look at the statistics and look at the conviction rates. We have that, but that's not working. So we really need to ensure that we develop different set of metrics so that we're investing in these young people.
Because what about the old-fashioned metrics? And I've asked the mayor about this. I've asked the attorney general, Brian Frosch, about this. I've asked people in the city council about this. You know, when you look at the murder rate per 100,000 people, the New York City murder rate is 3. Baltimore's murder rate is 55.4. We have 18 times the murder rate of 5 boroughs in New York. What is the difference between living in Baltimore and crime control in Baltimore than in one of the largest cities
so
in the world?
So again, Tom, I just talked about the difference. I talked about, you know, the demographics of Baltimore City and the poverty rate within this city in one of the richest states in the country. You know, when we look at those demographics, they come
Bronx?
Into play.
I mean, New York
they have Manhattan
a,
as well.
Yeah.
They
Fair
have
point.
Manhattan as well. And so, you know, when you can invest and provide opportunities for people, then it makes a difference. And unfortunately, we have not done that. We have not done a really good job with doing that. We have not invested in these young people. We have not invested in enough employment opportunities for folks. You know, I have a program called Aim to Be More for first-time nonviolent felony drug offenders. They go through a probationary period where they learn life skills, they learn job training skills, they do community service, and at the end of that probationary period, they're given a job and their felony records are wiped clean. Why is a state's attorney doing something like that? Well, because when these young people, mostly young people, they make these poor decisions, they get these felony convictions, they can no longer apply for a job, they can no longer apply for housing, they can't go back to school because they can't get any financial aid, and so then what other recourse do they have but to go out doing what they were doing in the first place? That in and of itself presents a public safety concern. That's the reason why I created the Crime Control and Prevention Division within my office. That's the reason why we're in these schools every single month. We've adopted for the past 3 years, you know, 2 schools in West Baltimore. This past year, we have 2 schools in West Baltimore and 1 in East Baltimore. I just came from an event where we had more than 200 young people that are part of my Great Expectations program. We focus on 4th and 5th graders and expose them to the positive careers within the criminal justice system. We have got to make an investment, and that has not been done.
The voters last November approved a referendum that gives the city $12 million plus dollars to invest in youth fund, what's being loosely called a youth fund. It's going to be administered by Associated Black Charities, and it's supposed to get money on the ground to people who are working on the street
in communities.
Lots of different organizations. $12 million is a lot of bucks. So, I mean, would that be a metric to look at a year from now to say crime and violence should be reduced because we are investing that kind of money in programs for youth, the kinds of things that you're doing in your office?
So I think that that's a measurable sort of outcome we can look at, some form of metrics. But, you know, think about how much we put into other sort of agencies. And if we put that same sort of money into the schools, we put that same sort of money into recreational opportunities, where would we be? We would not be in a situation that we're currently in. We did, you know, I got some criticism when in the beginning of the summer for Gun Violence Awareness Day, I said, you know, we're going to partner with the mayor's office. We're going to partner with the police department, do whatever we can, because we looked at the crime trends between the hours of 6 and 9 on Friday nights. We knew that there was an increase in youth violence. So proactively, I was saying, what are we going to do about it? Right. So my office ended up taking the lead on this, but we had pop-up events. And why were we doing this? Well, because we wanted a safe haven for these young people. We wanted recreational opportunities for these young people at the times in which there was an increase in predictability, mm-hmm. they're likely to be out here committing violence. We touched more than 2,437 young people in just those 12 weeks on Friday nights. The first event we had 550 young people that came with their parents. You know, it was free admission. They went to skate night and laser tag and, you know, bowling. These are the sorts of, you know, recreational opportunities that have been lacking. What are these kids doing? Why are they out here at 12 o'clock in the middle of the day, or, you know, even on Friday nights when we know that they're not up to doing something? We need to be more proactive. And you know, unfortunately, we haven't been.
I know the folks from Build, we got to take a break. We'll talk about this on the other side. But the folks from Build have suggested a number of things, one of which is just let's keep the rec centers open until midnight every night, 7 days a week. For 90 days.
Yes.
Let's just try that. Let's see what happens. How much can that cost, right? It's not going to cost a gazillion dollars.
Exactly.
Let's just do that and let's see what happens in 90 days. And then, you know, figure out something. Like, I mean, so I think there's such a yearning to do something now, you know, because.
And we should do something now.
Because systemic inequality and the systemic problems are long-term solutions. But boy, we do need to do something now.
And I mean, I just went to recently the Boys and Girls Club out of Gilmore Homes, right? And these kids were so excited, you know, that they had this opportunity after school program. But then, you know, after we went, it was like less than a month later, they closed it down. And the little girl in my Great Expectations program said, Miss Mosby, you remember me from Boys and Girls Club? I said, oh, yeah. How are you? She said, I'm great. But why'd they close down the rec center? What are we doing here?
Yeah. When you talk about the coordination, that it's not as easy as it looks, evidently. All right, we got to take a break. Marilyn Mosby is my guest for the hour. She has been the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore since 2015. We will have more with State's Attorney Mosby after this break, and we will try to take some of your calls and questions. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We are streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, where you're listening to Midday.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, it's Tube Talk with Midday producer Bridget Armstrong and WYPR's digital producer Jamila Krempel. We'll talk TV, what you might want to binge watch if you get a few days off next week, and we'll take a look at what's been going on in the world of streaming and broadcast television. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews The Revolutionists. That's at the Everyman Theater. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Madam State's Attorney, what is the effect of this really stunning indictment of the 8 officers in the Gun Trace Task Force, and then a 9th officer who's used to be in Baltimore is now in Philadelphia. 5 of these gentlemen have pleaded guilty to, you know, stealing things from people and intimidating people. We understand that so far about 175 cases in your office have had to be dropped. There's some estimates that say it could be as many as 2,000 cases affected. I mean, what's the actual daily effect in the state's attorney's office of this?
So, I mean, anytime you have any sort of allegations, and some of the allegations are now, you know, the individuals have pled guilty. So you have cops who have become robbers. It undermines public trust. It undermines those really hardworking police officers that put their life at risk and in jeopardy every single day. But for me, you know, the effectiveness of prosecution relies on the public trust in the criminal justice system. And so it's a no-brainer for me. I would tell you, if you're robbing people, you're going in with ski masks and, you know, stealing money, and people are being killed as a result of your actions, of these rogue officers, I would rather get rid of 200 cases than compromise the 49,800 cases, you know, that we prosecute a year. Unfortunately, we've had to expend a great deal of resources in the state's attorney's office assessing these cases, you know, because we cannot rely on the credibility of those officers, clearly. So it's a matter first of public safety. What we do is essentially look to see if we can corroborate the case without the credibility or relying on the materiality of those officers. And if we can move forward on the cases, we will. But if it relies on the credibility of those officers, we won't. I will get rid of those cases. Again, the public trust is so critical that that's what we rely upon in order to prosecute 50,000 cases a year in Baltimore City. And so I'm going to ensure that, you know, from my perspective, we're doing what needs to be done.
Justin Fenton of the Baltimore Sun published a long piece in the paper on Sunday about police detective Jamel Rayum, who is one of the officers indicted in this case. He has pleaded guilty to the charges. And well before this all happened, well before he was mixed up in the current indictment on the Gun Trace Task Force, he was implicated in a case in which he and other officers stole $11,000 from a suspect. How is it that, I mean, people wonder why it is that there's an officer who was implicated in this crime, and then a few years later he's promoted to the elite task force on guns? I mean, help folks understand how that happens in a police department, and how that happens, and prosecutorially. Mr. Rayum was, while it was proven that he was part of this $11,000 theft, he was still testifying in cases, I guess, right? I mean, he was still being used by your office. He needed to be used to prosecute cases. How does people seem to think there's a disconnect there?
What I can tell you is that, you know, one of the things that following Freddie Gray that I came up with were several sort of police accountability proposals, one of which was an independent investigatory agency to allow police not to be able to police themselves. It's not just exclusive to police. I don't believe any profession should be in the business of policing themselves or investigating their own. And then the other sort of issue was the civilian participation on trial boards. I think that is something that is extremely important. And what happened in that case, and I can't get into the specifics. Again, a number of these things are still pending, and I can't get into what happened specifically around personnel records and findings. But that was a direct result of these trial board proceedings, where we don't have that civilian sort of participation. And unfortunately, if that person is still employed by the Baltimore Police Department and is promoted by the Baltimore Police Department, you know, the only thing that we can do from the state attorney's perspective is to make a determination as to whether or not we're going to use them. And I can tell you that several of the officers were not several, but a few of the officers that had any sort of credibility issues, we took that into consideration, and they were not used. If they were used, a disclosure was made to defense counsel, which would indicate that this officer has been accused or has some sort of credibility issues. So anytime that comes up, this is something that the Office of the State Attorney has to pretty much disclose once we're given the a protective order in order to do so.
Another front page story in the paper today says that the defense at least for some of the officers who have pleaded guilty, or perhaps some of the officers who have not pleaded guilty but are going to trial, is that the crime was actually a theft and not a robbery. And when I read this, I mean, I don't know anything about the law. You're the lawyer. But it read to me like a skit from Saturday Night Live. Like, okay, we stole them, or we took the money, and that was justified legally, but then we should have put it in the evidence room instead of in our backpack. That was the crime, you know? So if that's the case, if that's the best move they can make to defend their clients, I just wonder what that does to long-term, to the trust that people have in the system. I mean, are you convinced? Here are these folks on this elite task force. They're shaking people down left and right, and they did it for years. Do you think it's no longer possible for rogue officers to operate with that kind of impunity in the BPD?
So what I can say is that you are absolutely right. You know, from my perspective, I think that community trust is paramount. We need it in order to effectively prosecute cases. And that's one of the reasons why we're taking the approach that we are and getting rid of these cases. You know, even those cases that have already been adjudicated, it's my office that is making a concerted effort to file these motions to vacate these convictions in light of the fact that this is just wrong. And so, you know, we're going to continue to fight for community trust. That's one of the reasons why, you know, we have community liaisons within every police district in the state's attorney's office. That's one of the reasons why we understand and appreciate that it's not just a policing issue when it comes to the violence, not just a prosecution issue, but we also need the community to come forward, right? We need that trust in the home of witness intimidation where the stop snitching mentality began. That's the reason why we've increased the grant funding in my office by more than 27%. That's the reason why we've doubled the size of the victim witness division in the state's attorney's office. We got $2.4 million in federal grants. We are going to continue to attempt to break down these barriers of distrust because at the end of the day, we cannot effectively make our city better and safer without the community.
I have an email from a listener, Philip, who says he references the results of the trials of the officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray. There were acquittals, and then you decided to drop the charges. That he brings up the case of Keith Davis Jr. He has been he was convicted of killing a taxi driver near Pimlico Racecourse, and he alleges that the police planted a gun near him, which caused him to be found guilty. So this listener asks, it's been through a hung jury and a mistrial. Why haven't you dropped Mr. Davis's charges?
So first, you referenced Freddie Gray, and I just want to be clear, right? Freddie Gray was a case that I was thrust into the international spotlight within a matter of 3 months into my term. I want to set the record straight that I wouldn't do anything differently. When an innocent 25-year-old black man by the name of Freddie Carlos Gray Jr. was unreasonably made eye contact with police, was placed in a metal wagon head first, feet shackled and handcuffed, defenseless, and his pleas for medical attention were ignored. I followed the facts with the law, and I wouldn't do anything differently. I can tell you that ultimately that accountability, you know, and I say this all the time, that accountability led to exposure. A week after I charged those officers, the Department of Justice came in, exposed the discriminatory policing practices of one of the largest police agencies in the country. That exposure ultimately led to reform. We now have a federally enforceable consent decree that even despite the federal administration that tried to forestall it is still on record. So I look at, you know, the Freddie Gray case, and we talk about those officers that weren't held individually criminally responsible. I went into this to reform the criminal justice system. I can say that we successfully did that in 18 months. Every single police officer is now being held accountable for the actions of a few. So understanding and recognizing that I will take on the challenging cases in the pursuit of justice. When we talk about Keith Davis, I think that there's a lot of misinformation that is out there. And unfortunately, it's an open and pending murder case. But I can tell you that with regard to even your recitation of facts, it's just it's not accurate. You know, Keith Davis was actually found guilty by a jury of his peer of being a felon in possession of a handgun after an independent.
Right, he wasn't convicted of murder. I misspoke. Yeah,
but independent.
He was acquitted.
So
of a
this
bunch
is what
charges.
Happened. Yeah. This is what happened in the case that is already closed, and he's been convicted in. He was accused of attempting to rob a taxi driver, a hack. That taxi driver alerted the police, and when he did that, Keith Davis jumped out of the car. The police officer followed him into a mechanic shop, and a civilian witness also witnessed this. Keith Davis had a gun in his hand. He ran behind a refrigerator, pointed the gun at the police officer, and it's not just the police officer's version of events. It's a civilian witness who also has this version of events. This was tried in front of a jury of his peers. He was found in the, once he pointed the gun, the officers shot back at him. They found him guilty. And let me say that the cab driver was unable to say whether or not that was Keith Davis. He was frantic. He said, hey, all I know is it was a guy with a gun. So, but we had the civilian witness that saw him come out, the police officer that saw him get out the car and followed him. In any event, he was convicted of being a felon in possession of a handgun. That handgun was tied to a murder 5 hours before. And so I can't get into the specifics, but there's more evidence that would suggest not just the gun that's tied to that murder that he's currently pending, but there's other evidence that suggests that he is the murderer. So my focus has always been Kevin Jones. This is not about Keith Davis. This is about Kevin Jones and how he lost his life unreasonably that day.
Okay, so we can't relitigate it here, of course, but there, when it comes to Mr. Davis's assertion that the police planted the gun, you don't believe that version of events, obviously. But
the jury of his peers didn't believe that.
But you understand, of course, that, you know, with this indictment of the people on the gun task force, that planting evidence is something that people are willing to accept as a plausible thing.
And, right? And, you know, that's, again, one of the reasons why I'm trying to break down these barriers of distrust, but that's misinformation. A civilian witness, you know, this is not just the police officer that is saying this is the man that I seen get out of the taxi and point a gun at me. It's also a civilian witness.
I'm going to ask you to put those headphones on. We have some callers on the line. Let's go to Barry in Baltimore. Barry, welcome to Midday with State's Attorney Mosby.
Yeah, good afternoon. On the police corruption or issue, I was a prosecutor in your office back in the 90s. And my trial team was one of the first to do the same-day jury trial. So we were inundated with misdemeanor cases that sometimes we had an hour to prepare for before we had to take them to trial. And we had the problem with police officers who had reputations for being dishonest. And it wasn't like these criminal officers on trial. Now, these were just officers who just lied about bad searches, just weren't trustworthy. So the prosecutors created a list. And since we had to move so fastly, this list, we didn't have time to research the background of this officer or get information about him because that's the first time we would meet them, and then we had to put him on the stand. So we created a list of officers, and you took it to trial with you, you put it on the table in front of you, and if this officer came across your case, you had to make a decision right there. Can I ethically put him up on the stand, or can't I? So we had to dismiss cases like that, and we didn't have time to go through a chain of command. It was kind of what we did. I was wondering, one, do you all still do the same jury trials, and how do you just handle not the officer who just turned a rogue criminal, but the everyday officer who just lies to make a bad arrest good?
Thanks for the call, Barry.
Thank you, Barry. First and foremost, I want to say thank you for your service. You know, when you're a prosecutor, you don't do it for the money. You do it because you're committed to being a public servant. So that's first and foremost. And I was a prosecutor at North Avenue. It sounds like you had a high volume of cases. It probably was at North Avenue. But no, the jury trial system is a little different. It's not the same day or the next day jury trial. They've focused it. And so now you have about a week to 2 weeks where you can pray a jury trial. So it's a little different. As far as your question with regard to when these officers are put, their credibility is put at issue, and it's brought to the attention of my public trust and police integrity division, we do take into light those allegations. And like I said, you were talking in reference to Patricia Jessamy's Do Not Call list. And that is something that in light of all that we've had to endure in the past 2 years and 11 months, it feels like it's been 31 and a half years. But I can tell you that that's something that we are considering re-implementing.
What can you tell us about the latest in the investigation into the death of Detective Sean Suter?
So, I mean, first and foremost, I come from four generations of police officers. My grandfather was one of the founding members of the first Black police organization in Massachusetts. I understand the sacrifice that officers make each and every day, time away from their families, and the sacrifice of their life to be a public servant. So anytime a police officer is killed, the way in which he was, you know, it's completely unacceptable. I can't get into the specifics of the case because it is an open and pending investigation. But you know, I am very, very, very sympathetic to not only the family of Detective Suter, but also to his colleagues. You know, this really hit home.
There are so many conspiracy theories out there. A gang member shot him. Another member of the police force shot him. He committed suicide. Are you confident, knowing the evidence that you know that the rest of us don't, that the FBI, when they eventually agree to take over the investigation formally, and as far as I know, they have yet to do that, right?
No, they have not yet done that.
It is their job, so eventually we assume that they will take over the investigation. Are you confident that they will be able to tell the public with certainty how Detective Suter died?
So, I mean, again, this is an open and pending investigation and everything is pretty much fluid. So I'm not going to put my confidence in another organization or I'm not going to say anything poorly about the FBI or the federal administration, but I'm hopeful and optimistic that they might take the case.
Marilyn Mosby is my guest. She's the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore. We will continue our conversation after a quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. We are also streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page. We do have some callers waiting on the line. We'll do our best to get to some of them when we come back. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. Elected at the age of 34, she is the youngest city prosecutor in the country. And given her high national profile, international profile, actually during the riots and uprising in 2015, she is likely one of the best known big city prosecutors as well. She was raised in Boston, but she has made Baltimore her home for many years. She and her husband, State Delegate Nick Mosby, live in Reservoir Hill with their two very beautiful young daughters. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. We are streaming live at the WIPR Facebook page. You can find us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. We have a caller and an emailer asking about the case of Tyrone West. Sheridan writes in, why you have broken your campaign promise to reopen Tyrone West's case despite new and overwhelming evidence that the police murdered him. Did you ever make that promise?
So we really need to be clear. I think I've been very straightforward. I never made any sort of campaign promise to reopen this case. And again, I am so sympathetic and I am so empathetic for that entire family to have to, you know, I commend them for, you know, even keeping his name and his legacy alive. It's unfortunate. Tyrone West, this incident took place 3 years before I took office. And what I can tell you is that I said that if there was any sort of additional evidence that we would look into whether or not we may be able to prosecute the case or whether that was even an option. But there was never any sort of definitive statement by me that I was going to open this case. Again, this is something that happened that predates me. I think it's really important. I think what we saw even in Freddie Gray is the beginning stages of an investigation are extremely important in collecting evidence. And so for me to now go in and to contradict what a previous administration made determinations and legal conclusions about would have to be overwhelming an abundance of evidence, which at this point, and again, this is something that we're currently looking into, I don't have. So I think that sums it up.
Karis from Baltimore writes in regarding this that according to the Sun, city residents have paid out more than $1.2 million in the last 2 years to settle three other cases in which the same officer was involved. This is an officer named Nicholas Chapman. He died in police custody. Mr. West died in police custody in July of 2013. Again, as you say, we're not going to litigate it here, but that's something that continues to be on the mind of a lot of folks. We have a couple more callers that we'd like to get to, if we could. Francis in Crofton, welcome to Midday with State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. I'd like to know the status of trafficking human beings in Maryland and surrounding states, and how best can citizens help you?
So, and I appreciate your call. Human trafficking is definitely an issue. We have, I-95, right? Crosses right through Maryland, and I can tell you that we have several sort of coalitions and task forces that we have surrounding human trafficking. I have a special my SVU unit that focuses on these issues. We have a 97% conviction rate. Again, this is something that we take very seriously, and not just human trafficking, but sexual assault. One of the things that I encourage, and I appreciate you asking what can you do, the community to do, is to not only stay vigilant and visible, but also to stay engaged. And engagement means not even just from the beginning or before a crime takes place and understanding and knowing your surroundings and your community. It's not just when a crime takes place, cooperating with police, understanding that we prosecute 5,000 felonies a year in the city and your case will be postponed. It's also staying engaged when we secure that conviction and understanding the importance of these victim impact statements and community impact statements. It also goes beyond that, because when you go to Annapolis, and this is where you can be extremely helpful, and I believe it was Francis, right? Francis, we need your help. One of the things that we've been pushing in my office, and we created under my administration a policy and legislative affairs division, is a sexual assault legislation. And we've been pushing the Serial Sexual Predator Prevention Act. And this is an extremely important piece of legislation. And we can understand why as we look at the Harvey Weinsteins and, some of the more the people who have been highlighted in the entertainment industry and even in the political world nationally. But this piece of legislation is for serial molesters and child molesters. When we look at the federal rules, they understand that when you talk about child molesters and serial predators, individuals like that, they usually have a pattern of predatory behavior, and thus their prior bad acts and accusations are tools for prosecutors to be able to utilize at trial. For 5 years now, I've been seeking and bringing a coalition of women and children advocates down to Annapolis to conform Maryland standards to federal standards. We have gotten this legislation as far as it's ever gotten, thanks to some legislators like Senator Brochin. I can say that for the first time 2 years ago, it passed the Senate unanimously. We had all of the votes in the House for this important piece of legislation. And unfortunately, I was told to my face by the chairman that he wasn't going to bring it to a vote because I had the votes. So what can you do? Please stay engaged. We're going to be right back down there. Last year,
if I understand it correctly, this would allow prosecutors to bring in past behavior of people accused of sexual assault into their current trial.
Yes. And let me just, I can give you the scenario. So about 4 years ago when I was running, an individual who was an eight-time serial rapist was breaking into people's homes in my neighborhood and raping women by knife point. He got off 4 times in 3 years. I thought that was extremely, I couldn't understand it. But what was happening was that he was very well-groomed, very articulate. These women who were strangers to him would have the courage and the audacity to get up and testify against him. And he would then get up on the stand and say, yeah, my DNA evidence is there, but these women consented to having intercourse with me and their prostitutes. The jury wasn't made aware that this same individual had been accused of doing this to 8 other women the same exact way. And so that's when I started doing the research and said, the federal system already recognizes this. 37 other states already recognize this rule. Why are we promoting a rape culture in Maryland? And we've been pushing this. So the governor last year picked this up as one of his number one legislative priorities. And unfortunately, we played politics. The year before, it passed the Senate unanimously. This same exact bill wasn't brought to a vote in the Senate or the House last year.
Decent chance it'll pass in 2018?
Absolutely. With this Me Too movement, we're going to keep pushing.
This is a email from Debbie, who says, quick note to say how helpful the victim witness program has been to me. I was a victim in 2015, and the case has still not come to trial. I've been assisted every step of the way from the competent and friendly individuals who are part of the program. So what is the victim witness program? And also, when we talk about trust, when we talk about the reluctance of people to come forward with information they might have because of fear of recrimination from people in the neighborhood, if they are seen as cooperating with the police. There was a terrible death of a woman named Charmaine Mitchell in June of this year that hinged on that kind of thing. When it comes to people trusting, as we say, we're under this consent decree and stuff, do you think, because trust was a centerpiece of your campaign when
Absolutely.
You ran, have we made any progress?
And I can say, yes, we have made progress. I mean, when we look at the conviction rates that we cited earlier, 93% felony conviction rate, we talk about public enemy number ones. You got to think about this, right? So one of the individuals, one of the public enemy number ones, his name was Capone Chase. He was a BGF executioner, alleged black guerrilla family executioner. He lured somebody onto a playground in broad daylight and shot him twice in the head in front of his pregnant girlfriend. Yeah, the police did an awesome job in apprehending him. Yes, my prosecutors are talented. They got in and they advocated. We secured this conviction. But it was really because the community stepped forward, right? It was Miss Gloria Hertzfeldt, who unfortunately just recently passed, who lived in that community for 40 years and said, No, not in my neighborhood. And even in the face of a murderer, that's the individual that did it. And what I try to emphasize to the community is that there are more of us, the hardworking, productive community members that want a safe city, than the small number of individuals that define that negative perception. So I've worked extremely hard to increase the funding, you know, for my victim witness unit. As I stated earlier, we had a $2.4 million federal grant, doubled the size. We have these additional victim witness advocates that we want to be able to walk people through every stage of that process. One of the things that happened when I first took office, where there were so many phone calls from cold cases, people who had been impacted, family members who hadn't heard from anybody, you know, regarding their case. My prosecutors are assigned homicide cases from the very beginning. And so it was a change in culture, but I said, guess what? You're assigned that case. So now what we're going to do is we're going to sit down, we're going to call that family in, we're going to ensure that we connect them with their victim witness advocate, their police detective, the assistant state's attorney that has their case, and the family bereavement center. We're the only state's attorney's office in the entire state that has lifetime grief counseling services. And we're going to sit down and we're going to explain the process and the criminal justice system before there's a perpetrator of interest, so that they understand that when somebody's been identified, what that process looks like.
We have just about a minute left. I talked to a prominent African-American businessman a couple of weeks ago who told me that he's so frustrated because when he tries to talk to some of the young men who are involved in the criminal justice system, they don't want to hear from him. They don't care that he has a successful career in business, that he's got this wonderful life that he's put together for himself due to the hard work and intellect that he brought to that endeavor. Most of the people killed, the 335 people who've lost their lives on our streets in the city, have had multiple interactions with the criminal justice system. Many of them have been arrested before. What is the capacity that you have as the state's attorney and the people in your office to change the culture on the street of people who are getting involved in this criminality? You know, we talk about drugs and opioids and the drug policies that clearly have failed in so many ways. But, I mean, do you think there is something that you can do as an elected official to change how people are thinking on the street?
I do. I think that, you know, I'm still very passionate about this job. And the reason why is because, you know, Frederick Douglass said it best. It's easier to build strong children than it is to repair broken men. And that is where we have to invest. We need to be in these schools. We need to get to these young people before it's too late. I just came from an event where over 200 young people, you know, who have been exposed to the positive careers and now want to be prosecutors and now want to be defense attorneys and want to be police officers. That is the key, but it's going to take more than just my office. It has to be a mass investment from every stakeholder within the community. That's business, that's the community, that's government, that's all of us.
Madam State's Attorney, it's good to see you, and I hope you'll come back soon.
Thanks, Tom.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Marilyn Mosby is the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore. She'll be seeking re-election next year, a race already joined by three contenders in the primary. We will be covering that race as well as all of the local races that will be on the ballot in the new year. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the Midday Tube Talk, a conversation about the best and the worst shows on television with Bridget Armstrong and Jemila Kremple. Also, J. Wynn Russick will be here. She's going to review a show at the Everyman Theater called The Revolutionists. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop. They're on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow night at 6:30, they're offering a class on the Mediterranean menu. More info on the web at baltimorechefshop.com. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.